Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. In this episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Lee No, who is a naturopathic physician that I have previously had on the podcast to talk about his best-selling book, Mitochondria and the Future of Medicine, the key to understanding disease, chronic illness, aging, and life itself. Since the time of that podcast, Dr. No has gone on to found a company called Cananda, which is a company that specializes in producing compounds, different plant extracts and terpenes that are designed to help optimize the endocannabinoid system, which is a system built into our biology that is involved in stress and pain buffering, involved in resilience, involved in energy, mood, brain function, sleep, and many other aspects of how our physiology works. So we get into that and we get into how these specific compounds work and how they modulate the system to our benefit. So without any further ado, enjoy this conversation, podcast number two, with Dr. Lee No.
Dr. Lee No, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. It's been a long while since we talked. You were last on my podcast 5 years ago in August of 2018. And you know, you're someone that I've always had a lot of respect for your work, and it's wonderful to reconnect with you after 5 years of not talking.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, but I'm happy to be back and chatting with you again.
Yeah, and your episode that we did 5 years ago is one of my most popular episodes of all time. I think it I don't know how many tens of thousands of views on YouTube, and just the YouTube side of it. There's also tons and tons of audio downloads on iTunes. So where are you now? Well, actually, for people who are unfamiliar with your work, you wrote a book on mitochondria that came out in 2017 or 18.
Yeah, 2018. Well, that's the most recent edition of it. Initially, that was self-published back in 2014, then got picked up by a publisher and republished in 2018.
Okay. So, and this was a hugely influential book on me. This was something that was very educational for me to read your book on mitochondria, and I learned a lot from it. Where are you now at with your sort of your relationship with mitochondria, your study of mitochondria, and all of that?
Well, you know, when I was in the process of having that book republished in 2018, I had already started another company. So my passion for mitochondria spans, you know, many years before the publishing of that book and continues to this day. But one of the things that I had done in that time was start a company, and that has really kind of taken the bulk of my attention. So even though I'm still passionate about the mitochondria, and I still dabble in looking at the research, it's one of those things where running a business that's growing, it keeps me occupied to the point where I really have very little time to pursue other interests, unfortunately. But yeah, my business is doing well, and I'm passionate about that. Super interesting stuff as well. So, you know, it's something's got to give. And one of the things was, you know, the mitochondria. But like I said, I still do keep up to date here and there.
Yeah. Okay. And so the business that you're alluding to here is Cananda, which Cananda, is a cannabis focused business. So
yeah, not so much cannabis. We started out as an ancillary cannabis business, or looking to target the needs of medical cannabis users. But we've since somewhat left that space and see ourselves as almost a standalone business, not dealing so much with cannabis or the medical cannabis users, but dealing with anyone that's essentially experiencing pain, sleep issues, and anxiety as the three main health issues we target. But of course, we do help a lot of other people dealing with other health conditions as well.
Okay, so the distinction between cannabis, is cannabis referring specifically to marijuana, or is it inclusive of hemp? Forgive me, as I'm certainly not an expert in that world.
Right. Yeah. So cannabis would include both, both the recreational side, the medicinal side, as well as hemp, and of course hemp has many uses, including a nutritious food. So we That term covers everything, but we, in terms of the ingredients that we use hemp as for some of our ingredients, but we also base our entire line on a class of compounds called terpenes, which we extract due to the way the regulations are in Canada. We extract our terpenes from non-cannabis sources. So that makes our products completely legal in the Canadian marketplace. And around the world as well. I know a lot of when you think of terpenes, they're essentially flavor and fragrance molecules, typically extracted from essential oils. But and so, you know, it should be legal everywhere. But the source where you get those terpenes from can make your product legal or illegal. And it's crazy because when you think of a molecule, the human body doesn't care where it comes from, whether it's an orange or cannabis, but from a regulatory point of view, it does make a big difference. So for us to have our products legal, not just in Canada, but around the world, we extract our terpenes from non-cannabis sources.
Okay, so let's zoom out for people who maybe are not knowledgeable of this whole space of terpenes and cannabis and the cannabinoids, and let's just big picture. So basically what you do is you take certain extracts of certain plants that are designed to do what? What's the end goal of these extracts?
Right. So our most recognized and best-selling line of products is called Cananda CB2. So the CB2, if you're familiar with the endocannabinoid system, refers to the CB2 receptor. And so when we think of the endocannabinoid system, which is typically seen as the master regulator of balance in the body or homeostasis, what happens is it's a system that jumps into action anytime a process goes off balance. And what it does is it tries to bring that back into balance. So if something's too high, it brings it back down. If it's something's too low, it tries to bring it back up. Now, it does so through the activation of these receptors, and the two main ones that we talk about are CB1 and CB2 receptors. Now, CB1 receptor is the one that's mainly found in the brain and the central nervous system. And when we activate it, we feel the intoxication. And so when we think of cannabis in the sense of recreational use and THC and people getting high, it's because it activates that CB1 receptor. On the other hand, we have CB2 receptors, and CB2 receptors predominantly exist in the periphery, so outside the central nervous system, and has an incredible anti-inflammatory effect. And that's one of the main ways it works. So when we activate CB2 receptors, we bring about a lot of the health benefits associated with cannabis, but none of the psychoactive the intoxicating effects associated with cannabis. So all the health benefits, but none of the high.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what are those health benefits? What do we get by activating the CB2 receptor?
Right, so like I said, it's mainly related to the anti-inflammatory benefits. And as you already know, inflammation is an underlying factor in pretty much all degenerative conditions. So everything from neurological degeneration, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, to cardiovascular disease, including congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, cholesterol issues. We see inflammation associated with things related to metabolism, like the way the pancreas works and insulin secretion, insulin sensitivity, the liver, the way the liver processes toxins and function. So the list really goes on. The crazy thing is that when you look at the endocannabinoid system and the presence of CB2 receptors, it's found in pretty much every single tissue and organ in the body. And that's one of the reasons why when we look at the health benefits associated with CB2 receptor activation, it spans pretty much every condition that exists. And again, that makes sense because it's found everywhere in the body. The research is fairly new and it's developing. A lot of research is going on. And I think one of the things that we're going to see coming forward is so many more health conditions can be helped by the activation of these receptors. But at this point, there is still enough research to show that, you know what, if you do have if you're dealing with any sort of health ailment, activating the CB2 receptors is likely a good idea and has been shown to bring things back into balance, or at least help kickstart the body in its healing process.
I think of human health and physiology through an evolutionary lens, through the lens of evolutionary biology. And one of the things I like to do to kind of assess whether something is logical or not, whether it makes sense to me, is ask, like, what is this, like, where is the precedent, the ancestral precedent for this, or where is the need for this based on the mismatch between how modern humans live versus how humans lived ancestrally, the modern environment versus the ancestral environment. As an example, it's like, well, what's the need for red and near infrared light therapy? Well, most modern humans are getting way less sunlight than we used to. It's very straightforward. And there's many other examples of that: heat and cold and feeding windows and intermittent fasting and breath holding practices. We have these ancestral precedents, and these things make sense in that kind of context. What is your understanding of, like, the endocannabinoid system or CB2 receptor activation through that kind of lens? Like, how does it make sense, based viewing it from that lens, that modern humans need to spend more time activating or doing more things activating the endocannabinoid system, or CB2 in particular?
Yeah, you know what? That's an awesome question. It's something I've never, ever been asked before. And admittedly, something I've not really thought of, previously. I will say that the endocannabinoid system is an anciently preserved system in all vertebrates. And so basically any animal that has a backbone will have an endocannabinoid system. So it's been with us for hundreds of millions of years. Now, when it comes to how humans, our modern lifestyle, might be somewhat deficient in activating the CB2 receptors and tonifying the endocannabinoid system, I guess I'm thinking off the top of my head here, but I guess one of the things, and this relates back to the terpenes that we talk about, the main terpene in our CB2 line is beta-caryophyllene. And beta-caryophyllene is what we call a selective CB2 agonist. So it activates the CB2 receptors without activating CB1 receptors. Again, that's one of the reasons why you get all the health benefits associated with cannabis, but none of the intoxication. Terpenes, as the main molecules and essential oils, are volatile compounds, so they evaporate quite readily. And our modern way of growing and distributing food, where we grow things in another continent prior to its peak ripeness, transported it thousands of miles to sit on a store shelf or a produce section, all those terpenes are just going to constantly evaporate. So by the time you actually ingest those foods, the amount of terpenes that you're ingesting is a fraction of what you would normally get if you were to eat that fruit fresh, or that food fresh.
That's super interesting. And that's the exact kind of thing that I'd be looking for to justify, to create a rationale for this. It's like, well, ancestrally, humans, picked a fruit and ate it. And now you get a fruit, but it sits around for days or weeks and is transported thousands of miles before you eat the fruit. What happens chemically to that fruit before it arrives to you? Okay, and now there's some connection between that and the endocannabinoid system. Now things start to make sense to me.
Yeah. So when you think of a fresh fruit and you pick it off the tree, you can just smell the aroma. It's so potent, it's so fresh. But you buy that same fruit off a produce section in your grocery store, it almost has no smell. And again, beta-caryophyllene being such a potent activator of CB2 receptors and found in many different fruits and spices, you can see that, you can imagine that our ancestors were consuming a lot more of these compounds than we do today. And of course, without those compounds, we're getting a lot less activation of those CB2 receptors, which, and you know, very similar to what I talk about in my book on the mitochondria, where a lot of the underlying processes show mitochondrial dysfunction. Well, a lot of the same health conditions are also showing a dysfunction of the endocannabinoid system or suboptimal activation of those receptors. So, so this is probably one of the reasons why that could be happening.
Very interesting. Can you go deeper in what the endocannabinoid system does, like how it's involved in regulating physiology and sort of like some of the mechanisms of how this works, like irrespective of any exogenous compounds, how is this working internally, and what systems, what mechanisms is it modulating to have those effects?
Right. So the typical as I mentioned, it starts with something going off balance. And when that happens, certain chemical signals are released. So as an example, in the situation of inflammation, certain inflammatory compounds are released, and that kind of wakes up the endocannabinoid system to alert it that there's something going on here, we need to address this. The endocannabinoid system is often seen as a modulatory has a modulation function. So what happens often is that things are a little bit too active, whether it's the inflammation is too active or the nervous system is too active, and it works through what we call a retrograde signaling. So typically what happens is the presynaptic neuron sends a message down to the postsynaptic neuron, but the endocannabinoid system works in the reverse. So when it sees that there's too much nervous system signals going down the nervous system chain, it sends the signal retroactively or through a retrograde signaling. So it goes from the postsynaptic neuron to the presynaptic neuron to kind of tone down that signaling and tame that overactive nervous system, whether it's nerve signals or things like things related to inflammation.
Very interesting.
The other thing I should mention,
yeah,
is that we do have our own endocannabinoids. So these are compounds that our bodies produce that activate these receptors. So as you mentioned, outside of exogenous cannabinoids or compounds that activate these receptors, our bodies would naturally produce these compounds. And to touch upon your previous question about, you know, what might be happening where we have this endocannabinoid system dysfunction or deficiency now versus before. Well, there's a lot of different things that could be going on, and the endocannabinoid system is somewhat complex. So one of the things that we see is some of these enzymes that are involved in the endocannabinoid system that break down our endocannabinoids, for some reason, what we're seeing is sometimes they're a lot more active than usual. So it's too active in breaking down these endocannabinoids. And so these endocannabinoids, which do have a health benefit and can bring about that balancing function, they're broken down too quickly. So they're not able to have that impact. The other thing is that we have something else called fatty acid binding protein. And these are proteins that bind our endocannabinoids when they're finished doing their job and then usher them out of our system. Again, for some reason, what we're seeing is a lot of, in various situations, we have an excess amount of these fatty acid binding proteins. And so it kind of neutralizes the endocannabinoids, so we can't do our job. And that's probably one of the reasons why certain exogenous compounds can come into play. So I'll touch upon CBD. I will also make it very clear that our products are not CBD. Our products are, we call it CB2, but it's predominantly based on beta-caryophyllene. CBD, however, what's interesting is even though it's a cannabinoid, actually doesn't even activate CB2 or CB1 receptors, but does seem to have an influence on the endocannabinoid system in different or indirect ways. And one of those ways is suggested to be to bind that fatty acid binding protein. So it kind of takes up the or occupies the fatty acid binding protein, so it can't bind to our endocannabinoids and take them out of our system. So CBD, it does seem to have some utility with respect to the endocannabinoid system, but again, somewhat indirect. And one of the reasons why I think exogenous sources of those types of compounds can help.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Whereas beta-carophyllene does act directly on CB2 receptors.
That's right. Yeah. And it's considered what it's known as what we call a full agonist. So that means when it binds to the CB2 receptors, it's going to elicit the maximum strength of a signal. THC, I should also mention, is a CB2 agonist as well as a CB1 receptor agonist. One of the reasons why THC gets you high, but it does bind to the CB2 receptors, but it's what we call a partial agonist. So even though THC can bind to those CB2 receptors and still bring about the same benefits that our product does, the strength of the signal is somewhat muted because it's a partial agonist.
Mm-hmm. It's worth mentioning this for people. As soon as you talked about anything related to cannabinoids, can you get high from this? You know, that's one thing that people with no sort of experience in this territory generally tend to think with anything related to hemp or cannabinoid, anything is, oh, it's like marijuana, it's going to get me high. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer with our product is absolutely not. Now, I guess one of the things that it's important to understand, again, is that it's the CB1 receptors that give you that feeling of intoxication or that high. Because our product is only a CB2 receptor activator, you won't get that intoxication. That being said, sometimes people ask me, is it psychoactive? And in a sense, our product is psychoactive in the true definition that it alters your psychology. And the way it does that is, you know, a lot of people will use it for things like anxiety or when they're feeling stressed, it can help calm you. But I would say, you know, even lavender or GABA or things like that, those are all, in my opinion, considered psychoactive because it does have an influence on your brain and the way you feel, but it's not intoxicating. So it's not, like I said, it's not going to get you intoxicated or high. Mm-hmm. Just to make that distinction.
Got it. So this, you know, what one of the things that I've learned over the years is that anything can be overdone. And when you dose something in too great of amounts, you get toxic effects or you get negative side effects. And this is true of literally everything. You can take the healthiest things in the world that I'm a huge advocate of, like sun exposure or exercise, or even food and water become toxic. If you drink 2 gallons of water in the next 10 minutes, you'll cause permanent brain damage and put yourself in a coma and maybe die. Right. So everything, including pure pristine water, can be overdone. Yeah. So of course that's true here too. And oftentimes there's no spacing on what the proper analogy is, whether a free lunch or something to that effect. But generally, there are some kinds of side effects when we start experimenting, especially with neurochemistry. I found that, you know, let's say you take a pill that alters your neurochemistry in a way that helps you focus, or alters your neurochemistry like caffeine or other stimulants in a way that gives you energy. What's on the other side of that? Is my question. And of course, we know with caffeine or Adderall or things of Ritalin, things of this nature, there are very serious side effects on the other side of this. Caffeine, for example, alters your neurotransmitter systems with chronic daily use. It alters your neurotransmitter systems in a way that actually lower your baseline levels of energy rather than raise them. So it's like overstimulating this creates, since the body is an intelligent dynamic system, it starts to adapt and go, hey, it goes, we're being overstimulated, let's make adaptations that remove some of this excessive stimulation effect. And that actually creates the side effect of lowering your energy with chronic use of this thing that's supposed to, that people are using to raise their energy. Right. And similar things are true with really every substance that tends to alter neurochemistry. So the question here, and I think the distinction here is this something that is bringing the body back into balance, or is this something that is pushing the body out of balance, like the use of stimulants as an example?
Right. So again, great question. I'm enjoying our conversation because you're really touching upon a lot of different concepts and things that I don't usually get asked about. So what your question, to answer your question, there's actually a few different ways I can answer it. So first of all, I'll talk about tolerance. So tolerance is the natural adaptation to a particular exposure to a particular substance. And what normally happens is over chronic exposure or high exposure, our bodies adapt, and it takes more of that substance to bring about the same effect. So using coffee as an example, you know, when I started drinking coffee in university, half a cup was sufficient, you know. But as I drank coffee on a regular basis, the amount I needed to get that same kind of wakefulness increase. So that is an example of tolerance. And same thing happens with the endocannabinoid system. What we've seen, especially with medical cannabis users, as well as chronic recreational users, is that, you know, a small amount when you're starting out is sufficient, but over time you're using more and more. And for certain medical cannabis users that we've come across, they're in the range of 7 to 10 grams a day, which is a huge amount. Of course, that happens over a period of years, but you know, it basically our bodies adapt to the point where you need more and more to get the same effect. What's interesting is that even though we've seen that with CB1 receptors, numerous studies have shown that we don't seem to see that with CB2 receptors. So tolerance doesn't seem to develop for some reason at the level of CB2. So at least in the number of studies that have been done, it doesn't look like you can build up that tolerance with CB2 agonist. So staying with the one particular dose seems to be sufficient. The other thing I should mention is that when it comes to the endocannabinoid system, it seems to operate, and again, I'm focused more on the CB1 receptor. Again, that's where a lot of the research that's been done in answering this type of question revolves around. And what we see is that the endocannabinoid system works on what they call a biphasic dose response curve. So most things, and I'll use caffeine as an example, work on a linear dose response curve. So you take a small amount, you get a particular response. You take a large amount, you get the same response, but in a greater intensity. With the endocannabinoid system, we seem to have you can think of it as a U-shaped curve. So, you know, you have a low dose brings about a certain response, but a high dose will actually bring about the opposite response. So I'll give you the example. I'll use cannabis again from a recreational point of view as an example, maybe not so much a recreational point of view, but a lot of people do use cannabis as to address anxiety. Now, the thing is if you're a novice user where your body has not adapted to that level of THC, or even if you're a regular user, but you just have way too much for your body's tolerance level, it's going to actually induce anxiety. So that's a perfect example of that biphasic dose response curve, where a small amount can bring about one response, but a larger amount brings about the opposite response. And to bring you back, bring the discussion back to the mitochondria. So the mitochondria actually have CB1 receptors. And some of the, this is preliminary research, just to let you know, there isn't a lot, but the research that I did see shows in some situations, activating CB1 receptors can actually induce the electron transport chain and make it more active. But in other situations, it can actually cause a reduction in the activity of the electron transport chain, which is the key component of oxidative phosphorylation, or creating energy through the use of oxygen. So when you look at these types of studies where the results are completely conflicting with each other, my immediate thought and going back to my understanding of the endocannabinoid system and that biphasic dose response curve, is that if you have a small amount of THC or anything that's going to activate those CB1 receptors, you're going to potentially increase the activity of the electron transport chain. But too much, you're going to have the opposite effect. So when it comes to using products like this, I think it is important to make sure that you're using the right dose, and the right dose for you might not necessarily be the same right dose for the next person. So it really is an individual thing. The last thing I'll mention is, and this is more specific to our products, is that every single product that we use, or ingredient that we use in our products, has a GRAS status, or generally recognized as safe. So these products are, these ingredients are considered food ingredients. So in terms of the amount that you would need to bring about, say, a toxic effect, is quite high. Now, of course, you don't ever want to overdo anything, and that's true with our products as well. That being said, we've not come across anyone that's reported any sort of toxic effects. So again, as long as you're using it the way that we recommend, there shouldn't be any issues with adverse effects or toxicity or anything like that. At least we haven't come across that yet.
So separate from like toxicity or some kind of acute serious adverse effect that like somebody takes it and really notices some really unpleasant effect, what I'm more thinking of is subtle adaptations that might not even be perceptible, but might be negative. Like as an example, 5 years ago in our last podcast, one of the things we spoke about with regards to mitochondria was some of the research, like Michael Risto's research out of Germany on antioxidants used around exercise, and how antioxidants may actually, and many studies do indicate, impair the adaptations that you get from exercise. And so this is something that somebody who's actually taking those antioxidants and maybe thinking they're doing a good thing, taking antioxidants right after they exercise or before they exercise, could do this for years without ever noticing anything negative.
Got it.
But they would have actually impaired a lot of the metabolic benefits that they would have otherwise received from that exercise. And for people listening unfamiliar with this line of logic, basically this revolves around hormetic stress, and that the benefits of exercise and other hormetic stressors are in large part mediated by the rise in reactive oxygen species or free radicals, oxidants that are produced in large amounts during the hormetic stress. When you take antioxidants close to that, you actually suppress that, and therefore you suppress most or a lot of the benefits that you otherwise would have received by allowing your body to adapt to that stressor. By right. Minimizing the stress on the mitochondria, you also minimize their need for adaptation. Something like that, even with coffee. Coffee is kind of an insidious thing because most people will not notice the effects of that. And similarly, you could look at anti-inflammatory substances that, like, there's research similarly with exercise. You take anti-inflammatories close to weight training workouts and you will actually suppress some of the adaptation there. So even with something, you know, we all have this kind of shared cultural narrative at this point, like inflammation is really bad. Inflammation drives disease, but inflammation is also necessary and is an important part of repair to injuries, to damaged tissues. And so what I'm thinking of here is if you're constantly pushing hard on the anti-inflammatory switch, maybe you're actually suppressing healthy inflammation in some cases. 100%.
Yeah. So as you were talking about that, and I understood your question. And yeah, you're 100% right. And we talked about this during our podcast last 5 years ago. And that is one of the ways that the mitochondria adapts to things like exercise is through that oxidative stress. And as you're talking, my immediate thought was going to inflammation, because our product is such a great anti-inflammatory. We do know that acute inflammation in many circumstances is actually a beneficial thing. And that's what can somewhat kickstarts our healing process. Those signals are received by our body. Our bodies send in a number of other chemicals to start healing the body. And if you're going to tone that down, you're going to blunt the response, that beneficial healing response. So 100% with our product, one of the things that we really want to emphasize is that it's at least with a lot of the research that's been done around CB2 receptor and inflammation, a lot of it revolves around chronic degenerative conditions. You don't want to be taming inflammation in acute situations. And because our product is such a great anti-inflammatory, if you're taking it during those acute phases, it's probably going to have a blunting effect on the positive effects of those inflammatory compounds. So it is one of those things where this is true for pretty much everything, whether it's exercise, certain nutrients, different foods. I think timing of taking anything or administering anything is incredibly important. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier was, red light therapy or infrared therapy. One of the things that I came across more recently is with the retina being so dense in mitochondria can actually have a tremendous benefit from exposure to red light. But what they found was that the timing of when you use that red light can make the difference between whether you're going to get those benefits. And I don't think it showed any negative effects, but if you don't use it during the right time, you're just not going to see any benefit. And I don't quote me on this, but I think it was, in the morning hours, if you expose your retina to infrared light, that's where the benefits are going to happen. And you only need to do that like once a week to get those benefits. So mm-hmm. Yeah, 100% timing of nutrients or any sort of therapy is something that doesn't get enough attention.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was actually going to switch to a timing discussion. One of the things that I've noticed for me personally, and I think that this is something that will have minimal amounts of translation for a lot of other people, especially people who are largely sedentary and dealing with chronic disease, degenerative diseases of various kinds. But I've experimented with this principle of like the thought occurred to me, maybe I'm overdoing it with some of the compounds that are anti-inflammatories, because I'm so physically active. I mean, I have days where I might surf for 2 to 3 hours in the morning, go play tennis for 2 hours, work out, or do, surfing and capoeira or jujitsu or like rock climbing and weight training all in the same day. Some days I have, 3 to 5 hours of exercise is very often pretty typical for me. And in multiple bouts over the day. And I started to, when I really overdo this too much, sometimes I'll feel chronically kind of inflamed and stiff. And some of that's normal. You're just doing some temporary tissue damage and inflammation in response to intense physical activity. But I felt like I just kind of had this intuition that maybe paradoxically, this chronic sort of inflammatory feeling that I have is actually related to too much use of anti-inflammatory agents. And so I backed off some of the stuff that I'm using and sort of experimented with like not using some of the stuff that I would normally use. And I actually feel like it allowed for a healthy expression of inflammation to occur after a lot of this intense physical activity. And now I'm interested in like experimenting more with timing. Like maybe if I leave a break of several hours after the exercise and then introduce some of the anti-inflammatory agents, maybe I can have mostly a beneficial effect. Anyway, it's everything I'm talking about is mostly speculative. And none of it's even reflected in my blood biomarkers. Like my inflammatory biomarkers are rock bottom. They're extremely low, but it's all just kind of a feel thing, an intuition thing, extrapolating from the same kinds of logic that we were just talking about, with antioxidants, for example. And, I'm glad you mentioned timing, because my hunch now is that timing of these things is really important.
Yeah. And I think, outside of, you know, dose, you know, when we talked about even water, you know, too much of water can cause some serious adverse effects. I think to a lesser degree, that the timing of nutrients will have a huge influence on whether you have adverse effects or have positive effects. And yeah, like I said, I think it's something that doesn't get enough attention. I don't even think that the bulk of the research community understands the importance of this. I think the few studies that have come out that looked at this, whether it's the red light therapy with the retinal benefits or the antioxidant intake and adaptation to exercise, things like that, there's some early hints that this is something that we need to pay attention to. But I think a lot of people just think that it's not a relevant aspect or a variable in many situations, which I'm going to guess if that research is done, we're going to see that timing is actually a critical factor. Even when it comes to something like sleep, you know, like some of the research I was seeing with sleep, depending on when you go to sleep. And again, this will vary depending on the individual and your own circadian rhythm, but depending on when you go to sleep and when you wake up, has a huge influence. You know, you could still sleep 7 hours, 8 hours, but when those sleep hours occur will influence how much of a benefit you get from sleep. So right. Yeah, I think it's a variable that is going to be something that should be looked at and will be looked at. And we're going to start to understand the importance of that sooner or later.
If you had to guess based on your knowledge of this area and personal experimentation, what would you say would be the optimal timing for the use of beta-carotene in your products?
If I had to say, I would say in the evening. And that's when a lot of the, well, in the evening, so that the anti-inflammatory benefits are taking place or having an effect while you're sleeping. And because sleep is so regenerative, I think that's when you know, that is the ideal time to have those benefits. And again, I'm speaking without 100% seeing any sort of research to confirm. And this is just, again, going based on my feeling and my intuition. But throughout the day, whether we're exercising or anything like that, we are kind of increasing those inflammatory markers, kickstarting the healing process. And at night, we can start to, you know, bring back tone down that inflammation or any sort of signaling so that our healing processes can start to kind of kick into gear and start to regenerate. And I know that has a huge benefit to things like brain health, where depending on different phases of sleep, we're starting to, you know, clear out a lot of the junk in our brain, so to speak. And I think that has a huge, a big part of that is related to the amount of inflammation that's going on. Mm-hmm.
Dr. No, I've really enjoyed this. Are there any final words that you want to leave people with? And maybe also, can you let people know what kinds of things you're hearing from users of this product and what kinds of issues and symptoms people are generally reporting the most positive effects from?
Yeah, so I, as I mentioned, I think the three main health conditions that people are using our products for. And the three main conditions that we see the most testimonials for are pain, sleep issues, and anxiety. But when I look at the breadth of different conditions, I would say it ranges, it's gotten to the point where nothing surprises me anymore. And I hear a lot of these incredible stories. And again, whether there's research to support it or not, again, it makes sense to me because our entire body is full of CB2 receptors. So I've heard amazing stories with respect to things like Alzheimer's, people, you know, at late stage Alzheimer's in a long-term care facility, almost brought back to full health after a few months of using our product, to migraine sufferers who, in one situation, I remember the person telling me that they were on Botox injections for migraines that she's had since she was a child. And after using our products, she's off her Botox medication or injections. I'd hate to, talk about the big C, but we even had, success stories with that, where I can't say it was definitively diagnosed as that, but when you have an ongoing open sore that fails to heal, for a couple of years, that is very suspect. And, using our product, after a few months, the sore actually healed for the first time in a couple of years, and the lump under there kind of decreased by half the size. So we have a lot of different testimonials covering a range of different health conditions. But like I said, I think the vast bulk of the users are using it for pain, sleep, and anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Dr. No, let people know where they can follow your work or learn more about your company and your products.
Yeah, so you can check out our website. It's cannanda.com. That's cannanda.com. And on Instagram as well, which is Cananda Crew.
Awesome. Thank you so much, my friend. I look forward to our next conversation, hopefully not 5 years from now.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks again for having me, Ari.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family. Help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.